My name is Katie, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Melissa will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Melissa. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not aligned with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the Serenity Prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know what to do.
Chris will read the steps.
Thank you. Excuse me. The steps. One. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Sorry. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jeff will read the traditions.
I'm Jeff, I'm alcoholic. The 12 traditions. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, and the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of tonight's meeting is one 10-minute speaker, our information break, and followed by our main speaker, who will speak for 25 minutes, and then our anniversary celebrants. Our 10-minute speaker tonight is Dolores.
Yes. Oh. Good evening, everyone. My name is Dolores Beaufort, and I am an alcoholic. While I was in college, I took a course on alcoholism, and I was required to attend an AA meeting. When I finished the course, I realized that I had a problem with alcohol. So I went back to that meeting. I declared myself an alcoholic and asked them for a sponsor. They gave me a lady's name and told me to call her. I called her, and she said, "Dolores, can you meet me at 60th Street and Park next Tuesday?" And I said yes. That day was March 19, 1986. I am truthfully grateful to this building for my sobriety, and that I really mean. Also in that course, the professor said that an atheist was going to come and teach us about the spirituality of the program. I am a black female Roman Catholic, and I thought he was totally out of his mind. So I had nothing in common with this guy. So anyway, the professor told us that he found his higher power in the big book on the third edition, page 449, that Shakespeare said the world is in it and all of us are players. I thank God for that man. He was doing what we now call cooperation with the professional community. So therefore, I found out that day that this program is a very spiritual program. It is not a religious one. I grew up in an Irish Roman Catholic neighborhood. I sang "To Our Lord, a Minster Boy" by Young on Bunny Banks. I stuck in an Ava Nagila, and somewhere came along Granada. They looked at me and said, "Oh, yes, maybe you can even sing Joshua Fought the Battle of Jericho." That was the way I grew up. My mother had a nervous breakdown when I was 9, and I became the responsible one. Most days, I was a child, even though I was the oldest child. Other times, I was the oldest who helped my father make decisions about what was going into the house. And that is the way I grew up. We were poor. I had poor black friends and poor white friends. And one of the things we poor people had in common is we weren't brainy enough to go to City College. We definitely didn't have enough money to go to Columbia University. So we all got married, and heaven only knows what that story is all about. But anyway, I have 3 children. I have a girl and twin boys. And at this present time, they're doing well. Of course, my marriage didn't last. Actually, what I'd like to do is tell you about my sobriety. And that's what I usually do. I'm a step in tradition person and a big book person. I was told to take the cotton out of my ears, put it in my mouth, listen to learn and learn to listen. And I still go by that today. I may be embarrassing a couple of people, but anyway, on my 14th year of sobriety, I told my sponsor, "You know, I don't feel like doing too much, da-da-da-da-da, blah-blah-blah." And she said, "Take yourself back where you came from." So I came back here when I had 14 years, and I sat with people who didn't look like me, who were shorter than I am, and they sat down and said, "This is the way we do the big book, prayers, promises, warnings, and directives." And I want to thank those leaders who sat with me and taught me a great deal. Even though I had 14 years, I did not know. My first year of sobriety, my first to my fourth year of sobriety, was pretty nice. I can remember my first year like it was yesterday. I met a woman in the dentist, and she had about 20-something years, and that was one of the miracles. In my second year of sobriety, I thought I was going to be all gung-ho and do some service. What happened, I got sick and I had to go back home. But one of my sponsor's friends knew it was my anniversary, so she told everyone. In my third year of sobriety, I was told that I could, I asked to speak on a big book, and I did. My fourth was okay. My fifth year of sobriety, I want you to know that I felt every gook, every sexual thing, everything I had ever done. And if anybody's ever gone out in their fifth year, God knows I understand. In my 60, everything was fine, and guess what? In my seventh year, I lost my apartment. Not because I don't work, because I work for the city, but because New York became a little bit too expensive for me. So therefore, what do? I grab what was taught to me, the first step, the second step, and the third step. That's what I did. My sponsor also landed off when she went to New Jersey, so I was really not feeling well that year. In the ninth year, I began to have deaths. Now, in my 10th year of sobriety, as I work for ACS, that is the Administration for Children's Services, those who are responsible for removing children, I was required to take a 17-year-old to school. What happened is, I don't think anyone can take a 17-year-old to school. So the judge told me that if you don't, I will either have you fired or I will have you put in jail. Fine. So what do? You hang on to first step. Step two and step three. I won that, and everything went just quite well. Now, in my 15th year of sobriety, I was told that I should have a biopsy. I don't suggest this to anyone, but I did. My 18th and 19th was fine. Now, my 20th year of sobriety, which was last year. My last year, 20th year of sobriety in May, I had the biopsy. I was fine. In June, one of my sponsees burned to death. In July, my sister rolled out of her bed and she was dead. And in September, I had a flood in my apartment. I don't even remember what happened then. I said, yeah, I don't even want to. But my life is filled with the big book, steps one, steps two, and steps three. I know most of us say we live in 10, 11, 12. I do try to do that. But I find that if we have adversity in our lives, one, two, and three works for me. I understand that we're going to have a dance. So, I've got to tell you about this dance. I was about 50 years old, looking a little younger than I do now. And my sponsor said to me, Dolores, would you go to the AG 60th Street and Park dance if I gave you a ticket? And I said, yes, I would. Well, I want all of you who are going to the dance, and especially the young lady that I met this evening, is the first time she's here, come to the dance. I never felt alone. I never felt left out. I never felt like I didn't belong. I felt like I was a part of. I didn't dance, but I enjoyed the music. I talked to everyone, and it is one of my greatest memories in sobriety. My favorite traditions are the ninth and the seventh. The seventh tradition, although it talks about money in the basket, it also is supposed to teach me how to govern my money outside, but it doesn't. I do have credit card debt. But what I'm trying to say is that the traditions do apply to us. The traditions really do. They do apply to us, as in my girlfriend does hair, and just because she's in the fellowship doesn't mean I can pay her cheaper than I'd have to pay a hairdresser. That's the way the seventh tradition works for me. The ninth one talks about how I must continue to do the steps and traditions in order so that we may stay sober. It's right in that tradition. And that's what I like about the traditions. It's not only for CNY, Southeast New York. I've been to DCM and all of the everything outside of the crowd. It is also good for me as a person. I do want to say one more thing. I have two more minutes. Okay. When you get up here, you're so nervous and all of a sudden you back to the big book. Oh, I want to thank everyone for allowing me to do service. I am the literature chair on Friday, and literature does keep you sober. When I first met my sponsor and she told me to come here to 60th Street and Park, she was downstairs in the basement. That's where they were. And the place was crowded just like this. And I said, oh, God, I will never find her. But my sponsor was doing service. She was selling tickets to a dance. And that's how I found her. So from the very beginning of my sobriety, the role model that I was given is do service and you stay sober. I'm not going to continue to talk. I think I've run out of things to say, and my stomach's so bad, but this is one thing I will tell you this. Most of you have heard that you have stinking thinking. My thing is T-H-I-N-K means to me, thank heaven, I now know that I have a disease that I can arrest one day at a time, and I thank you so much for allowing me to share.
And our main speaker tonight is Frank.
My name is Frank. I'm an alcoholic. And I wasn't nervous all day until I got here. My home group is the Airmont Group in Suffern, New York. I have a sponsor. I'm sober since March 5th, 1996. And I owe that to God and Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank everybody that came with me because if I was here alone, I don't think I'd be able to stand here and look at the mic. I told my sponsor I wasn't going to wear my glasses, so I didn't have to look at everybody. I had my my first obsession with alcohol when I was 8 years old. I was at my my aunt's house. I had to live there because at my house it was a lot of chaos, and my mom was always sick. My father was always drunk. So I used to go to the country in the summer and all the holidays, and they had a rolling bar downstairs, and I used to sleep downstairs, and they had these two big bottles of, I found out today, that one was rye and one was bourbon, and I would go over to them, and I would tell my cousin, I'd say, smell, and we would take a whiff, and it would be hot, and I would be like, come on, let's drink it. And he was a year older than me, and I used to always try to get him to do stuff. He was like the scapegoat, and he was afraid to do it. And ever since that day, I always wanted to drink. Now, I was exposed to alcohol and drunkenness in my house, and I really never wanted to be like that. I mean, I vowed my whole life to not be like that. But yet, I was looking at those bottles quite, like I was very interested. I like to say that when I was 10, I had my first drink. I had known where my father kept his Fleischmann's whiskey. It was in the closet in his suit jacket pocket. And I knew it was there because I was practicing from my unsuccessful burglary career. And I used to like to go through all the drawers and through the closets and know where everything was. And when the time came, I knew where the whiskey was. And what happened was they were fighting. My sister was yelling at my dad. My dad was yelling at my mom. And I was a little guy, and I had this big truck, and a little toy truck. And I was wheeling it around, and I just couldn't take it anymore. And I know that if I didn't take that drink that day, I would have committed suicide. Because I know that alcohol saved my life that day. And what happened was I went in the suit jacket pocket, I took a sip, and it went down, and I'm hoping everybody here knows that burning. And it hit me, and I was like, I got in my truck, I wheeled it inside, and I didn't hear no more yelling. Life was okay. I didn't care. And the thought came, hey, go get another one. And I went in, I took another sip, I threw up all over the bed. I got beat pretty badly. I don't know if it was for drinking the whiskey or puking on the bed, but I got severely punished, and the good news was I didn't have to go to school the next day. So I had pros and cons for drinking, and that's how it started, you know. I remember a year or so later, we were going on a field trip. I was in fifth grade, I think, and I stole the Fleischmann's whiskey. Me and my friends, we were on the bus singing Don McLean's American Pie. That's a good drunk song. I remembered it the other day. I was like, it was on the radio, and I was like, wow. We got to where we were going, and we all fell out of the bus. We just fell out, passed out, and I started blacking out right away. I wasn't easing into this. I was like right in there. And, I drank with the older guys, and they were doing all that other stuff, and I was doing it with them, and I stopped drinking for a little while. You know, I stopped drinking, but I kept getting in trouble, and I kept getting in trouble, and like I said, it was an unsuccessful career, and I spent a lot of time in the New York State Penitentiary, and I'll spare you the details of that stuff. But what happened there is I know today that you guys and God hang out in the lowly places and they come to save souls. And at that time in my life, I was open. I was as willing as the dying could be. I mean, I lived in Manhattan for a little while. I got released from jail. And I got a job down here with a guy that I used to know, and I tried getting sober. I was coming to meetings, and you know, when I was sitting there, I was thinking about how lonely I was, you know, and my family, and everywhere I ever went. I mean, I could go to weddings and just feel like I was all by myself because nobody knew what was going on inside, and the only thing that eased that was something other than feeling that, you know, whatever it was. I was walking up and down Manhattan, going to AA meetings. I had a job. I found a hostage. We got a dog. That's like the third time. I mean, the first time I was in the Bronx, I got a dog, two dogs, and a car. And I always worked for a little while. Like, I always say work's not part of my story, but I did work. I did try to work, but then it was on me. I knew you were going to find out what I was thinking, and I was always thinking bad, you know, and so I would have to leave, you know, I would have to leave whatever good life I was getting out of it, and that's what I did. I did that until I was 34. I am 11 years sober now, so that makes me, I think, 46, something like that. School wasn't too big on my list either. So what happened was I wound up violating parole and going back to jail to wait for the parole hearing. And while I was there, these nice guys were coming in from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to the AA meeting. And I had already heard about Alcoholics Anonymous while I was upstate. Let me back up a little bit. I was one of five out of 750 guys in the correctional facility to get approved for outside Alcoholics Anonymous. Prior to that, while I was waiting to go up there, a friend of mine was there, and he was telling me about it, and he was saying, I'm going to AA, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, and I'm like, I'm not coming home for years. I don't care about that. And then I finally wound up in this facility, and I was the guy that got one out of five. That's the odds are great. And I got to do that, and I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that something was happening here. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know how to tap into it. I was afraid to ask anybody what the heck you people were talking about. I would go to the 79th Street workshop, and after the meeting, I would go outside and I would stand with my back to everybody. Because those are my social skills. And I would wait. I would wait for somebody to say, hey, you know, how you doing? Or you want to go get coffee or something. And, you know, you guys did that. You know, you had the nerve to tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, we're going to go to the diner. Would you like to come and have some coffee? And this is no lie, and there's people here that know, not what I said, but I would say, no, I really have to go. Thanks anyway. And where I had to go was a room on 85th and 1st, where when you sat on the bed, the wall was like 4 inches away. And I would go there, and I would just sit there, and I would wait it out through the night, and I would start all over the next day, and I would just count the minutes until I could go to sleep. And then when I woke up, I would just do it all over again, and it was horrible. It was horrible, and I didn't think I belong there, you know. I like to welcome the addicts. I didn't think I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous, and here's what happened, you know, because I was talking to Helen today, and she told me to imagine you guys were naked, and I said, if I do that, I won't be able to talk. So, where was I? I had to say that joke. I told her I was going to say it. Okay. Thank you. So I would come here, and I would say to myself, you don't know. You know, I'm not like that. I really don't. And I would separate myself from everybody as fast as I could because you just didn't understand. I'm different. I'm not like you. You don't know. And what happened was I wound up in, whenever I try to dry out, I would go to Mommy's house, and I would stay there. She lived with her boyfriend, so I had the house to myself, and I would kick, and I would dry out, and I would come back here, and I would do it all over again, and I'd go back up there. And what happened was I got violated. I came to this suffering group up in Rockland County, and 3 years before that, I ran into this guy, and he was chairing the meeting. I walked up to him after the meeting, and I said, how you doing? Look, I don't know if I belong here. He said, why not? I said, well, I don't like drinking anymore. I said, you know, I'd like to do that other stuff. And he said, well, you know, if you drink, you're probably in the right place. I was on methadone for 8 years, and, you know, if you drink, you might be alcoholic. So he asked me if I had a big book, and I had just stole the one that when I was upstate to bring home with me, and I didn't even steal it. I had a guy steal it because I was afraid of getting caught. So I had the book, and he said, go home and read the first four chapters and call me when you're done. That was in 1992. So this time when I got out, I called him the next day, and he said, you want to go to a meeting? I said, where? He said, in Mahwa, New Jersey. I said, what's a Mahwa? And I'm not allowed out of the state. I'm sorry, I can't go. And I just did the whole cycle again. That was in 92. This time, I went to those meetings in the jail. I went to the meeting looking for this guy because he was Italian and he was on methadone for a little while. That's the only thing that qualified him to be my sponsor. So I went looking for this guy, and we proceeded to, he showed me what it meant in the doctor's opinion and in the first four chapters, what it meant to be alcoholic. And as the months were going by, and I mean, I thank everybody in AA that really, like, loved me or even allowed me, I won't even say love, they allowed me to be around. And you don't know what that means to a guy like me. I mean, they were inviting me to their house for Thanksgiving. You know, I mean, you know, that doesn't happen. They were telling me to come back. I never was invited anywhere twice. So I started to feel like, you know what? Maybe I do have this thing. And that's not the bell, right? Whew. Got a long way to go. I started to feel like, you know what? I think I'm in the right place. I started reading, and I started identifying about the mental obsession when I'm not drinking. You know, and I went back through my history. I looked at each sentence and how it applied to me personally. You know, I got to find myself in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and that allows me to be here, you know. And the longer I stayed, the more things became clear. You know, I got up to page 21, and I was very upset. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde guy, I was like, how did they? I called the guy, my sponsor. I said, how did they know? He said, how did they know what? He said, how did they know about me? You know, he says, they were just like us. I said, it was a long time ago. He said, they were like us. They recovered. Are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? And you know, I looked at him and I was like, there's a couple of things I ain't willing to do, pal. From where I came from. And I didn't say it, I thought it, you know. And what I said was, what do you mean? And he said, are you willing to do what the first 100 people in Alcoholics Anonymous did so that you could recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body? And I said, what do you mean? And he showed me in here where it says seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, the first 100 people recovered. And I took the book and I said, I worked in every prison library I was ever in. I'm going to go home and read this thing. I don't have to talk to them ever again. And I went home and I called them. And I said, how do they know? You know, it was like, it fit me like a glove. And if that didn't happen to me, I don't think I would have belonged here, you know. So thank God for the literature, like Dolores said, you know. I started working a program of recovery. People were giving me CDs and cassette tapes of AA speakers. And I remember when I was in those telling my friend Jay that when I had like 90 days, I aspired to speak at the World Convention. This is like almost like that to me, you know. It's the most people I ever seen at one time. And, you know, and I listened to these guys talking, and you know what? You know, the worse they were, the more hope they seemed to have, you know, because I had nothing. I had no answers left. I had nothing going for me. And I was willing to believe. I was willing to believe that this thing was going to be okay. And I was watching him, and he was living like this. And he was, and he told me in the beginning, if I ever tell you anything that's not in that book, you could tell me to go somewhere. And I've been waiting 11 years to tell him to go somewhere. So, you know, he's my guide, you know. I have other people that I check in with, because my thinking, you know, I'm not responsible. I'm not responsible for my thinking. I'm responsible for my actions, because I can't help the way I think. You know, this is the brain I have, and so I started working a program with him. He came to my house, and we did the third step together, and something happened. You know, sometimes an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. And we both, and this doesn't happen for everybody, I sponsor a lot of guys, and what happened to me was we got up and I was looking around and there was something present, you know. And I believe God made that clear to me, that I wasn't just going through the motions here. He, you know, it says when we seek him, he discloses himself to us. And it happened for me, you know. And I believe today that that's what enabled me to move forward. You know, I mean, I'm not a guy that I'm, you know, virtuous and all that stuff. And if that didn't happen to me, I don't think I would have been able to write an inventory. And so I became alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the point I was trying to make. I started doing this work here, and my friend says, if you do the work, God shows up. You don't have to believe right now. And I had always believed in God. I just didn't know how to allow him to come into my life to show me how to live. I thought I knew. I thought, you know, there was a guy that was going to come here tonight, because a lot of my drinking I really can't share, because I was a blackout drinker right from the start. So I would call, my famous morning thing was, hey, what happened? You know, where's the car? You know, where's my tooth? You know, I fell. You know, that's the way it was. That's the way I drank. And that's when I was good. You know, I was bad, but that was when I was okay. So, I don't know. I go to the last time around, before I got sober, I went to the rehab. They let me go. I mean, guys like me don't go to rehabs. When you get violated, you go to jail. And they said they're going to let me go to rehab, and I went to the rehab, and the guy there, I'm going back, but he walked up to me and he said, why are you here? He's my counselor. I looked at him. He was like happy. He was like Peggy over here. He's like, why are you here? And I looked at him and I was like, parole? Why? What do you think I'm here for? You know, I don't know how I got here. And he got sad, you know, because he thought he saw something. And wait till you hear this part. He got sad, and I looked at him, and I started crying. Now, I thought I was a tough guy, but I broke down like I was sobbing and heaving. And I know today it was the first time I ever told the truth in my life. I told him, I want to learn how to live. You know, I just can't take it anymore. And it wasn't that bad. You know, I got over. I didn't have to go to jail. I went to the rehab. I was eating. I mean, everything was okay. And because of the way he looked, I told him that, and he got really excited. He, you know, he beamed. And I was very upset about it at the time because I thought he was laughing at me. And he gave me his big book, and he told me to read one of his stories. I think it was The Man Who Mastered Fear. And, you know, like, just things were very clear for me, you know. And because of what I said about being the only guy, one of five going to Alcoholics Anonymous in the jail of 750, I said, you know what, I don't want to live like that no more, and you got to tell me what I need to do. And they said, go to a meeting. They said, pray in the morning, call somebody, make a meeting, thank God at night, and pray, read, call somebody, make a meeting, and thank God at night that he stayed sober. And I did those five things until I started doing the third step every day. And I just started feeling like I'm alive. And I just kept getting better. And life was life, you know. I just started getting better. And I've been through a lot of stuff, you know. I made a pact with God. I said, I'm going to work for you. And I meant it, you know. Like, there was nobody else. There was nothing else for me to do. And I know today that I have a new employer. And if I keep close to him and perform his work well, he'll give me what I need. And, you know, I married the nurse in the rehab. We have two children. I have a company that I you know, it's mine. I got a business that I own. And I don't think about drinking. You know, good, bad, or indifferent. I don't think about drinking. You know, it's like I closed on the house. I got fired that day. Girl says to me, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to AA. What am I going to do? You know, I went to an AA meeting every day for 4 years. I never missed my home group for 4 years. Two meetings on Tuesday, two meetings on Saturday. I see guys today, they tell me, oh, I'm tired. I drove a garbage truck since I'm alive and when I worked. I used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and then go to the meeting and then at noon and then go to another meeting at night. You're going to tell me you're tired? I mean, you know, you need to look at that. So don't call me what you're tired. Yeah, so, you know, my mom passed away and I got married sober. You know, I married the nurse and half of Alcoholics Anonymous at my home group was at the wedding. You know, I never, ever, I'm never alone, you know. If you guys ain't with me, then God's always with me, you know. And I don't have to feel like that no more. Lonely is worse than alone. You know, I remember I was alone a lot. You know, I got locked up while I was locked up a lot. That's nothing. But when I feel like I had no guys that have everything in the world, and I said, why'd you stop drinking? I wouldn't have stopped drinking if I was you. And he said, Frank, it's not what you have or what you don't have. It's how you feel inside. When you're done, you're done. And that's what I ask people. Are you done? And this morning I was at a meeting, and we read Into Action, and we talked about the family afterward. And I don't know how that worked, but, you know, people were talking about their in-laws, and they were saying, you know, the other side of my family. And I started thinking about that. And it's like, you know what? I don't have an other side of my family. You know, I'm so graced by God that they allowed me into the family, whether it's my wife's family or my family or your family. You know, like, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous brought me into their home, and they said, welcome. And my family said, welcome back. And, you know, God says, welcome home. And I started thinking about that in the meeting, and, you know, like, if we're all God's kids, and that's the highest you could go, I was told, become one of God's children, then I could not judge you, and I cannot, you know, do anything bad. And I fall short. I'm not a saint. But these are ideals that I learned by, you know, lately, since 3 months ago when you guys asked me to do this, and I had to think about it a lot. I've been practicing the 11th step on a daily basis. And the more I look at me, the more I know where I need to change. And the more I know I need to change, the more I know I can't change. So the more I go to God. You know, the more I get close to God by taking an inventory and asking Him to remove it, the easier it is for me to perform those actions. I don't get to do it 100% of the time, but at least I'm aware of what I'm doing today and how I'm acting. And thank you for letting me come.